Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. COVID-19 is gone from the daily headlines now, but 5 years ago this week was the start of a public health emergency like none other for tribal nations and across the globe. It took a toll on lives, businesses, and the public's confidence in the medical establishment. The impacts of the pandemic continue to affect us. Today we'll hear from tribal leaders and others impacted by the pandemic and revisit lessons we all learned along the way. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. On his last day in office, President Joe Biden commuted the sentence of Leonard Peltier. Peltier had already spent nearly 50 years in prison for the murders of two FBI agents in South Dakota in 1975, a crime he denies doing. The 80-year-old AIM activist is now living in his homeland of North Dakota and has not granted interview requests from many news outlets, including National Native News. However, the Associated Press's Graham Brewer was given access recently, and so far is the only journalist to interview Peltier after his release. I talked to Brewer, a Cherokee Nation member and longtime reporter, about his visit with Peltier.
He was in good spirits. I met him at his new house on the Turtle Mountain Reservation. He has a really nice little two-bedroom home with an office where he's planning to write his next book.
Brewer says Peltier gets around with a walker or cane and is eager to start painting, something he did while in prison. After years of campaigning and lobbying for freedom, Peltier confessed that he began to lose hope.
He was pretty convinced that he was never going to be released and that he would die in prison. One of the details he told me that really stayed with me is just even on the plane ride home, he kept having these feelings that the plane would disappear and it would all be a dream and he would be back in his cell.
While he enjoys support from many in the Native and international community, Peltier acknowledges that there are those who oppose his commutation. One is the FBI, while the other are relatives and supporters of Anime Pictou Aquash, an AIM activist whose body was found on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1976. Denise Pictou Maloney has long accused Peltier of killing her mother. Brewer says he asked Peltier about this opposition.
Yeah, they're still very unhappy, the federal law enforcement, that he was commuted and able to be released. In terms of Anime Pictou Aquash's family, they're still very much convinced that Mr. Peltier had some knowledge of her death or was involved in some way, even though two other men were eventually convicted and incarcerated for that crime. He was very clear that, you know, he considered her a friend and a colleague, that he had no knowledge of her death and was very happy that the two men who were convicted of it were tried and put away.
And how he'll spend his final years, Brewer says Peltier expressed a passion for working with the next generation of Native American activists.
He really wants to train them on the threats that they'll face and encourage them to just show up and be present and protest the taking away of any kind of land rights or indigenous self-determination or tribal sovereignty or treaty rights. He thinks that's still a really important part of being an activist today and that those threats are still very much alive.
Meanwhile, some Peltier supporters say that he deserves a full pardon and that President Trump should grant one. Brewer says that possibility wasn't touched on much in their conversation, but Peltier maintains his innocence. He had been sentenced to two consecutive life terms for the agents' deaths, plus 7 years for an armed escaped attempt in 1979. And indigenous entrepreneurs are meeting in Las Vegas this week for the National Center for the American Indian Enterprise Development Conference. Dr. R.D. Plato, managing director of Yellowtail Healthcare, a national healthcare group, wants the Trump administration to be cautious about federal health cuts.
There's an incredible lot of anxiety because it seems like there's not a lot of planning going into these cuts. It's like, let's jump in and just start swinging the machete and cutting stuff. So that keeps you up at night.
The acting head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Brian Mercier, also attended, telling people there are opportunities under the Trump administration for Native entrepreneurs, especially in energy and economic development. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The coronavirus struck the nation and indigenous communities hard starting 5 years ago. Schools stopped classes, businesses closed, and some people's already low level of trust in medical science started eroding further. That all with the backdrop of more than a million people who died from coronavirus infections, a highly contagious disease that hit Native Americans harder than other populations. Many schools, businesses, and tribal operations have not fully rebounded to what they were before the pandemic. Today we'll talk with some Native leaders about how they look back on the pandemic years, what they learned, and what they might have done differently had they known then what they know now. We'll also talk with a Diné counselor on a lesson for school students she created to help them heal any grief through Navajo kinship relationships. We also want to hear from you today, our listeners. Join us with a comment or question. Let us know what you remember about the onset of the pandemic. Call us, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also leave a comment on our website or social media pages like Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Let's now meet today's guests. Joining us from White River, Arizona is Gwendina Lee Gatewood. She is the former chairwoman of the White Mountain Apache Tribe and co-chair of the Indigenous Women's Leadership Network. Gwendina, good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a snowy morning here, but it's good. We need it.
Yeah, we sure do. Thank you, Gwendina. Joining us from the Lacouture Reservation in Wisconsin is Dr. Rebecca St. Germain. She is the Director of Tribal Healthcare Administration Data Innovation. She is also the CEO of St. Germain Data Innovations. She is Lacouture. Rebecca, hello and welcome to you as well.
Anine, it's a good day to be here. It's a good day to be Native.
It is a very good day to be Native. Yeah, thank you, Rebecca. Joining us from Loop, Arizona is Lavinia Cody. She is a certified school Diné counselor. She's also Diné. Lavinia, good morning to you as well. Great to have you on the show.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, it's Ebene.
Great to have you, Lavinia. Yate. And joining us from Kayenta, Arizona is Jonathan Nez. He is the former Navajo Nation president. Of course, he's also Diné. Jonathan, good morning. Welcome to Native America Calling.
Oh, yate, Sean, and thank you for having me.
Yate, it's good to have you on the show. Good morning. And all of our guests on the show today, I can't believe it's been 5 years. Gwendina, I want to begin with you. Do you remember when the COVID-19 pandemic, when it first hit the White Mountain Apache tribe and what the initial reaction was?
Initial reactions came long before we had our first positive, and I'm reflecting back on, I think, February, March, we began preparing our tribal members about there's a virus, you know, across the ocean for the elders that wanted to understand what was going on. We had to convey that message. We immediately started working with our tribal health partners, our tribal member community, our stakeholders, everybody. And I can remember that day. It was election day here on our tribal reservation. And it was April 1st. It was April Fool's Day. And people, I think some were like, no, that can't be. But that was the day we got our first positive. And it sent a shockwave through the community. And because they had been hearing about this virus in another location, another country, it really affected a lot of people in a lot of different ways. So, of course, the election, I believe people just were like, I was going to go vote, but now I'm not because I don't know what's going to happen. I do believe that that happened during that time because we were in an active voting day period where people could, you know, go in. But during that time, we had already pre-planned to have people to vote by car, through the car, where the precinct members could just come out and meet them. So it was a very challenging day that day, and so subdued. I remember going on the radio, our local station, KNNB, and delivering the news that we had our first case, and people were very affected by that.
Mm. I know you instituted a number of measures to protect your people, to protect your community. Looking back, which ones were the most effective, Gwendina?
As hard as it was, I believe the measures that we took, the tribal council, hats off to them, the tribal member community, IHS, Johns Hopkins, I mean, all of our stakeholders, everyone came together. Our EOC, they were the most resilient group because they were the core of we need to do this, and they would deliver the orders and the measures that council would then hear them out and pass those measures. It was a work in progress. And the things that worked, I know for sure, are the contact tracing measures. It was a powerful tool proven over centuries, and patients were infected for days before they were tested. We live in a rural community. We're 3.5 hours from Phoenix. So unaware of how sick people were during the asymptomatic period, you know, many people entered the medical care late in the disease process. So the contact tracing was very efficient. Tribal council, the EOC, all the different tribal departments and the tribal member community, we set up shelter-in-place measures. We had work with the different state, county, and national representatives. I met with Jonathan Nez. Thank you, former president, who I highly respect, and he gave his counsel. We shared what's working, what's not, what can we do. And we had drive-through pickups for devices. We had to close the reservation to non-member entry for recreation, just part of our shelter-in-place measures. We closed the forest down. We had a curfew. We had to have curfew. We had to close the public places. We had to postpone religious gatherings, which was really difficult, especially for the tribal ceremonies that were taking place and the different measures that we had to implement. I think every single one of them worked in some way in tandem to help slow the spread of COVID during that time. But the contact tracing, I cannot say enough good things about that, because our multi-generational homes, people not having access to phones, internet, what have you, they went door to door, and that helped us to reduce that spread.
Gwendina, looking back in hindsight, and of course hindsight's always 2020, but is there anything that you wish you'd done differently?
I mean, when you're in a pandemic and you're facing something that you've never encountered, and you're just learning from history what the elders did in prior, when sickness would come upon reservation land, sheltering in place. They would go to the mountains, they would separate, and the sick people were left alone. Going back to that mindset and implementing it, it reminded us of how strong we are as Indian people. And if we could do something different, I myself personally, if we could have had real-time results from the very beginning, that would have been great. Because there was a time where we had to get our tests done at the local hospital and they had to ship it off. And we wouldn't wait, and we couldn't hear the results until days, you know, to a week later. And by that time, the disease has spread even more. And I think going forward, health sovereignty, taking ownership of our healthcare system is essential. Investing in training, empowering our healthcare workers. Communication and transparency was very important, but during the pandemic, it showed us the weakness that we had, that we do not have broadband where it wouldn't reach certain places. And when you're asking your college students and your students, you have to study from home, but you can't equip them with the proper broadband so that they can learn within their homes. That's a challenge. And that wasn't fair to the students. And that is something that if we could have done that better and have a more stronger broadband, I'm hoping that right now that our tribe is working to fulfill that responsibility for our tribal people, because it not only helps the tribe, it helps our hospitals, our law enforcement, our schools and education working together so that we can rise above challenges like that, because communication is so important during something like this.
Right, right. It's interesting to hear you describe the need for real-time results, because I was just at the store the other day and they had a shelf full of the COVID tests, and I had forgotten how long we had to wait just for those test kits and how hard it was to get them available in those early months. And now it's almost like, yeah, there they are. There's the test kits. Every season you see them on the store shelf. So Gwendita, thank you so much for kicking off this conversation and taking us back to those early weeks of the pandemic and the impact there for your people, the White Mountain Apache. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue the conversation. We'll talk with Jonathan Nez. We'll talk with our other guests as well. We'll get these different perspectives. And, again, here it is, 5 years since the onset of the COVID pandemic. And please, listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you'd like to share some insights of how the pandemic impacted your community or what your community has learned from the pandemic, give us a call. We've got the phone lines open, 1-800-996-2848. That number again is 1-800-996-2848, and we are waiting for your call. For the first time, two Native students placed in the top 10 of one of the most prestigious science competitions for high schoolers. The Regeneron Science Talent Search awards innovations and groundbreaking research. We'll hear about the award and the two Native winners on the next Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We are discussing what the experience of COVID was like 5 years ago with Indigenous leaders. And you can join this conversation. Call us with a comment or question at 1-800-996-2848. That number is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Former president of the Navajo Nation, Jonathan Nez, joins us now from Kayenta, Arizona. And Jonathan, early in the pandemic, the Navajo Nation made headlines as being singled out as having the highest fatality rate in the nation with regard to COVID. It was really, really shocking news. Do you remember how that information impacted you at the time? And what did you do to reverse the trend?
Well, Sean, let me first say that, you know, when the virus came across the ocean to the northwestern part of the United States, we on the Navajo Nation began to prepare, just as similar to the White Mountain Apache Nation. You know, we we were able to get the message out using social media and making sure that our people were informed about what was happening in the world and in this country. We didn't have an infection on the Navajo Nation until well after the states around us had their first COVID positive case. And then once we were surrounded, we declared an emergency on the Navajo Nation, and not that far into the future, the first case was here, and you know, and it went like wildfire here on the Navajo Nation. Of course, we have high rates of diabetes and heart disease, health issues that made it very hard for people, and we were categorized in the most vulnerable population, and what that with that happening, you know, a lot of our people succumbed to the illness, and of course, per capita, we were number one in the country of COVID positive cases. But later on, we were able to flip that around to be one of the most vaccinated people in this country, if not the world, by over 75% being fully vaccinated. Of course, that was two shots at the time.
And how did you do that? How did you get those vaccination numbers up? And how did you do the outreach and just get the community informed?
Well, of course, as you noted, we were in the news a lot, and we used the news to get information out to our communities, our nation, and of course, our neighbors around, and using social media accounts, getting the information out daily. Town hall meetings, letting everybody know where the people were being infected, to stay home. Of course, at one point, we had to lock down the nation. We took our sovereignty seriously, the ability to govern ourselves by shutting down our nation from traffic flow and also encouraging people to get vaccinated. I know it was very controversial at the time politically. I know people were protesting out there saying, you're taking away our freedoms by forcing us to wear masks or encouraging us to take vaccines. But, you know, here on the Navajo Nation, it wasn't about our individual freedom. It was about others, protecting others, protecting our family members, our community members, and also our Navajo people. And I thank the Navajo people for following the advice of their leaders, which at the time I was the president, which I surrounded myself with healthcare professionals, scientists, and physicians who guided me. And that's how those recommendations came to be. And, you know, even at one point we were touted to be a model for pushing back on any type of virus. And some even said that if people, rest of this country were to follow the protocols in Indian country, we would have been out of the height of the pandemic a long time, but it got so politicized that, you know, of course, to this day, we still feel the after effects from that within our families and our communities.
Right. And that whole the politicizing of the whole dynamic, did that surprise you, just the extent of the way it became so polarizing and just, like you described, just the rhetoric that was out there? Did you anticipate that at all? And if so, or if not, how did you deal with that? Just imagine just the stress and just that constant conflict and turmoil that so many of us had to experience.
Well, I mean, we had a president that was very vocal in his thought process. We have him again as president, and and words are powerful coming out of leaders' mouths, and we have to be careful in how we speak, and not to divide the people, but to unite the people. And on the Navajo Nation, the way we united the people was, we use our Navajo teachings, our Navajo philosophy. You know, there's a story about the twins and how they were given weapons and armor to fight off monsters that came to attack the Navajo people. So when I was on the radio, I used that same teaching. This is a new monster called COVID-19, and the weapons and the armor to use to combat this new monster is the masks, the vaccination, and getting the information out to our community members. And I think, and I appreciate our elders, folks that were over 70 years old, they had the highest vaccination rate here on the Navajo Nation of over 90%. So it just tells me that our elders were out in the forefront telling the younger generation to follow their leaders and to follow these protocols that are coming from their leaders. And, you know, I commend them. And that's the reason why we were able to turn it around here on the Navajo Nation. So thank you to our Navajo elders and, of course, our teaching.
I think a lot of our listeners and myself included, we worry, what if it were to happen again? What if we were to see a similar public health crisis? And if that were to occur, Jonathan, in the near or far future, do you think the Navajo Nation is ready?
Well, with the infrastructure now in place, no tribal community is ready. We are building more healthcare facilities. We are getting more resources to those healthcare professionals under the previous administration. And now with the new administration, those dollars are being cut. Pandemic research is being cut. And that should be a concern for everybody because those are professionals that help guide us through some difficult times. And in this case, through these types of bugs that come into the community and pandemics. So I am very concerned about what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. Mm-hmm. And we all need to stand up, hold our leaders accountable, and let them know that we need to continue to build the infrastructure in Indian country so that we can all prepare for any type of emergency, even a pandemic.
In addition to the infrastructure that you cite, what about with regard to the frustration with the rhetoric, with the people that were opposed to the lockdowns and such? Do you think if a similar public health crisis were to occur, do you think that the Navajo Nation would be better able to handle some of that backlash? Or do you think we'd see a return of some of that anger and frustration?
Well, I think you'll see anger and frustration off tribal communities. You know, let me just be frank, too. You know, I probably lost my re-election bid because of the tough protocols I put in place during the pandemic. But, you know, the question that you asked, Glendina, what would you do differently? You know, knowing that I may have lost the election because of these protocols, you know, I would say, you know what, I would do the same thing over again. And at the end of the day, we're in it to save lives, not to get reelected into office. And that's what we did. And others took it in a different way. It was all about politics. And that's my concern these days, that it gets politicized in a way to where those decisions are made because of, you know, being reelected or, you know, moving up the political ladder for a lot of folks. But, you know, I think Navajo Nation would be prepared to go into a pandemic awareness phase if there was a bug coming in. I mean, right now, there are viruses. COVID is still out there, too. And there's so much lessons learned, of course, but bringing those same professionals, healthcare leaders, and elected leaders together was what really helped us, you know, transition and save a lot of lives here on the Navajo Nation.
Of course, you're still heavily involved in politics, and I'm sure you communicate with other people who are running for tribal council or other elected positions. And do you know of any people right now, or even just this last election cycle we just saw, do you know of anybody that incorporated any of these concerns about a future pandemic into their platforms? Or have elected leaders kind of moved on from it? I'm curious.
We when we transition out of COVID, you know, everything moves so fast. We didn't give, and you'll have a counselor on. We never had the ability to talk about this and have healing circles about what we went through. We just went back to work, went back to that fast-paced life, and there's a lot of trauma that came from this pandemic. And I'm afraid that if we don't talk about it and heal from what we went through, this is going to be another generational trauma into the future. Now, to your question, my wife and I run a consulting firm, NES Consulting LLC. We're helping other tribes with projects and also giving them guidance about what to do. And I think a lot of folks during the time when we were doing these town hall meetings were actually, other tribes were actually tuning in to our live feeds to get information because they weren't getting any information from their state counterparts, other governmental bodies in their state or in their county. And they just wanted to make sure that they were informed and to share that information. So I think there are a lot of lessons learned, and we need to sit down and have a debrief about those lessons learned and make sure that there is something that we can have in writing for the future leaders, the future of our communities, you know, in case of another pandemic in the future.
Thank you, Jonathan. Gwendina, back to you. I want to ask you, what concerns or what fears are most prevalent for you with regard to the prospect of a similar public health crisis in the future?
I just worry about the rural community that we're in. And Jonathan raises a good point about all these cuts for healthcare, the system. It's making us have less resources to respond to things like this. And despite the challenges and the victories of the past, we also need to be prepared for a possible pandemic in the future. The reality of our interconnected world means that new health crisis could arise. And as leaders, as tribal members, as world citizens, it's our responsibility to learn from the past and take proactive steps to ensure that we are better prepared next time, creating that mindset of continuous readiness. Our elders were excellent teaching those readiness teachings to us. You always have to be prepared. You have to have this. Because of this, it's not waiting for another crisis to act, but it's consistently investing in public health infrastructure, training, community education. Our people deserve the confidence that should another pandemic strike, we will respond swiftly and effectively. And I know our local Indian Health Service here and all the local responders and other stakeholders are fully equipped to help. And then Jonathan raises a good point about the mental health toll on our people. We do need to help our people in that sense. We have to talk about it and get that to lighten up. And we have excellent resources here, Apache Behavioral Health Services, Rainbow Treatment Center, Johns Hopkins, the list goes on. Indian Health Services even has a social services center. That behavioral health part of who we are as Indigenous people is so important. And protecting our vulnerable populations, our tribal elders, they are our thread to the distant past. That's who we have to rely on, and we need to protect them. We need to protect every individual, no matter what. Yes, we may have upset people about the measures we put in place. We can always replace material things. We can always replace things, but we can't ever replace a life. And COVID made that a reality to us. And as tribal leaders, as stakeholders, we all came together to implement those measures for a reason. And I'm so very thankful to our tribal member public and the people that live here, our allies who help us. Thank you for helping us get through this pandemic. But we need to preserve our cultural and spiritual health. And we need to get these lessons and start applying now to prepare our young ones so that should another one happen, we've already equipped them with the tools to respond faster. And, you know, we can choose how we prepare for it. but we have a DNA of resilience inside of us as Indigenous people. We maintain vigilance and strengthening our unity. We'll be ready to face whatever lies ahead, but we can't ever forget the powerful work of the Creator, maintaining that communication of prayer, asking for help during this time and for the future to help us, because our ancestors' strength runs through us and together we'll endure and thrive. And I'm so very thankful that we came through this pandemic that really tested us. And we have to continue to prepare, even if they give us the cuts, even if they're taking funding away. As Indigenous people, we went through that before. They tested us with trying to make us forget our language, putting people far away from their traditional homes, but we still rose above. That tells me that we have promised that we can do it again, but we just have to keep continuing with what resources we have, becoming self-sufficient and doing what we need to do, you know, engaging in our sovereignty to make sure that we can overcome what another pandemic may bring to us.
What do you remember, listeners, about the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic? What have you learned personally? What have you learned in your community? What has your family learned? Give us a call. You can join the conversation at 1-800-996-2848. We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our other guests on the show today, Dr. Rebecca St. Germain and also Lavinia Cody. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Trickster Cultural Center in Schaumburg, Illinois hosts a youth powwow May 31st, Pride Celebration June 7th, and the National Gathering of American Indian Veterans July 18th and 19th. Info at TricksterCulturalCenter.org, who support this show.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're going to wrap up our discussion on what was on the minds of Native Americans 5 years ago at the start of the COVID pandemic and what has changed since then. You can join us with a comment or question by calling 1-800-996-2848. Let's hear now from Tribal Health Administrator Rebecca St. Germain. She joins us now from the Lacouture Reservation in Wisconsin. Rebecca, you found out about the first infection on Lacouture almost exactly 5 years ago today. Tell us, walk us back to that time. Did you feel prepared at the onset?
Well, actually, I was enacted to come to the reservation because we had heard there was an illness coming. And on our reservation, the ceremonial life is paramount to our people. And being a statistician, I started constructing a plan, because the first things to go on our reservation, because we have such high need of jobs, unemployment, transportation, our reservation is very large for the northern tribes up in our area, and we don't have internet. You know, we were at a loss of how to get the messages out to neighboring villages. We have 17 villages, 34 communities. And so on 3 days after I was ratified, the question came up under executive order, when we went into shelter at home, I said, where are the homeless people going to go? Where are those, our relatives? Where are they going to go if they suffer from meth and heroin addiction? Because putting them back into the homes was not an option for many of them. So 3 days later, the first shelter in Wisconsin arose for homeless men, Native men, and I was very grateful. I made a few phone calls to one of our local agencies, and we got a sum of money to start the homeless shelter. And I didn't know at the time that would be such a blessing, because the issue when the order was put through for shelter at home, that essentially closed our casinos, it closed our roads, it closed the grocery stores, it closed all the vital enterprises and entities of the tribe. So that was a change in how we do business. You know, all of a sudden, you know, healthcare became a something that was almost unattainable. The local hospital expressed to me that, and the through the public health, the county officials expressed to me that if the tribal people come to the hospital, we may not be able to treat them. So that started a conversation with the ASPR, with the CDC, with the IHS. We need help on our reservation, and policies have to change. Funding has to change. We have to get access to medical and health professionals. So what started? What started? Those men that were previously homeless, previously suffering from other, what we call social determinants of health, all these terms, epidemiological terms start coming out. But those men gave with their lives, because when we had to remove clients and patients and our relatives from the homes, it was myself, for example, it was a man or two men who would come and carry our patients out, and we would put them in COVID isolation homes. We opened up 13 homes that we could remove those who were sick and put them in places where they could recover. And I'm very grateful to our PharmD pharmacist that came out with me, and he was able to assess their O2 sat. You know, we were able to take care of the patient when, you know, we needed to buy food. We needed to make sure they were able to get their medication. Our clinic had even closed because they were only serving frontline workers at the time. We didn't have vaccines. We didn't have access to enough medication in this northern area. And food, our local Walmart went into restricted hours. So we made the call to, I called Chicago. I knew that they had food services there, and Chicago responded. They said they would send up semis, and by golly, we had semis coming up with the food box, and that's actually what started the first food box distribution, and we became a hub. So every week, the men at that shelter would lift by hand 23 tons of food to deliver, and we would go out to the jails, out to the other county areas. In fact, we were feeding not just the tribal residents, but also the counties that surrounded us. And we have seven counties.
And, Rebecca, yes. I'm curious to also ask you, I mean, what did you learn personally, and as a healthcare professional, as an administrator, what did you take away from this in terms of how you do your work and your whole philosophy towards health, for tribal health?
You know, we've always believed in what we call Bemadizi Win, Minno Bemadizi Win, the good life. And within those teachings, and these are elder teachings that we carry with us, and that was love and compassion. So using the men of that shelter, it was a compassionate care approach, and they got it. They got that message. So for once, we were taking them to a place where they could be of service, not only to themselves, not just to recovery, but to serve others. So that changed my philosophy, one, on how we look at our own relatives that may be struggling. You know, pandemic or not, they were still struggling. But through this pandemic, it showed me the strength and the physical strength of our men. And, you know, we were building homes. We were changing the face of our reservation because of this pandemic. And the other part of this, as a statistician, as a healthcare provider, our aspect of just following policy changed. It had to change. This was a medical emergency that we first called. And we responded not just on the public health level. And boy, I'll tell you, we had some conversations, you know, with the CMS, you know, talking with the head directors there, that things have got to change. And I said, I will write your template. I will send you the letters. The language that we need is tribal leaders and tribal administration. This is going to change because there's no other way. And so what it did is it strengthened every work that we touched. Mm-hmm. And I have to applaud the tribe the tribal councils for standing by that, because I'll tell you, sitting in the meetings daily, hour by hour, with the ASPR, you know, that's the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, they were giving us information. CDC followed the meeting after that. They were giving us information. And
okay.
Finally, it went down to the IHS. But again, it was still very policy-laden. So we changed the way we were affecting health care. And I was very, very strong about those words, because I could give them numbers. I could give them everything. At the time, Commander Wiaki was in charge of the IHS, and he would ask me, because, you know, getting the accurate data from our tribal people was not compiled. They were just using, the funding was only going out based on the number of houses on the reservation, not on the population and the accompanying complications of this illness. So we did have some change of message when we spoke in large convenings.
All right.
And one of the other things was, I really concentrated on the funding for physicians, like Chairman Nez said. We have to have direct contact as sovereign nations, as sovereign governments. We must have direct communication to those agencies, to the congressional vault. For example, Chairman Nez, we found out during those conversations, Native tribes do not have access to the stockpile for vaccines. And so that was a conversation, you know, I actually called up Harvard Medical School and I said, you know, give me Joe Kalt. We got to have a talk here, you know,
okay.
Because these are tribal governments, you know, coming
right.
in.
Rebecca, thank you so much for all these insights. And again, just everything that you dealt with there with regard to the tribal health programs, and it really brings back so many memories of just how stressful and just how fast-paced that whole period was 5 years ago. I want to bring Lavinia Cody into the conversation now. She is a certified school Diné counselor. She's in Loup, Arizona. Lavinia, let's talk about the approach that you took with regard to the pandemic. And what you did is you focused on the grief and developed a way for school children to process tragedy. And you created a really, really interesting curriculum. What inspired you to take on this task?
Yes, thank you for having me today. So this is a topic that was very personal to me, you know, how it affected me from the beginning of my school counseling career. And so I was affected by the COVID on the Navajo Nation, and unfortunately, I had lost my grandmother, Shemasana, and also my mother a week apart due to the COVID-19. And so it really had an impact on me. And then going forth with healing, I decided to get into the mental health field and work with children within the Winslow Unified School District. And I was a new school counselor, didn't have any experience other than working as an intern with Navajo children. And so when I went in, I just had lost my family members 6 months, you know, prior. And so I went in and, you know, I just seen a lot of the students suffering from grief. It was something that was personal to me, but yet I knew I had to be there for them, especially, you know, coming from a culture, rich traditions, you know, there, I just knew that there had to be something done more on a cultural level to relate to my Native students. And so there was an opportunity that had come my way through the Northern Arizona University, the Indian Country School Counselors Institute Professional Development Program. And so I was part of that, and they helped me come up with, guide me into how to formulate this curriculum that I am presently using for my students. And it is titled Navajo Diné Cultural Based Healing when confronted with grief using familial kinship relations concepts of kith. And so my approach is to help my Diné Navajo students through the grieving process, especially targeting the ones that have lost a family member due to the COVID. And I've seen that there was children that had lost parents, there's children that had lost grandparents, and coming from multi-generational homes as well. And so I took this personal, my own personal tragedy and formulated a curriculum to help them, because I knew what they were going through. And so if we could utilize our clanship and kinship roles, so our students wouldn't feel isolated, they wouldn't feel alone in this healing while they're at school, so they could relate to others wherever they may go. I remind them that, you know, you're going to run into relatives that will support you and help you along your way in life.
And Lavinia, tell us more about the curriculum, if you would, and just how the students respond to it and the difference it's making there in the school.
Okay. Well, presently, the way I am teaching my curriculum is in a six-week course, an hour a week. And so I bring my students together. We brush up upon the Navajo culture, bringing in the cultural narratives and learning about everybody's clans and how we identify our own four clans. For example, my clan would be Ashiham, and I have four clans, Ashiham, born for Nakaidine'a, and then Bipatwotni is my Chase, and then Hanani is my Nalis. So we all learn those four clans, and we learn to identify the clan groups, how we are related to one another, how we address one another if we are related in that sense. We practice these our kinship roles and how we it's more about self-identification. And so we go over lessons, learning about the roles, how we address one another, where we come from. We learn about our family history, our families, clans, and we learn about the stages of grief. So it's everything that's all incorporated into this curriculum that the students learn so that they're able to go forth and help them know where they are in their own grief process and talk about it with one another, with their clan, if they have a clan sister, clan mother. And so for me, I identify myself as their elder, that I'm there for them to support them in any way that I can.
Okay.
That's where I come from.
Lavinia, thank you so much for sharing this. And what's so wonderful about this curriculum as you describe it is I see so many applications for it, not just with regard to the pandemic, but so many other challenges and issues that our young people face. So thank you for all the work that you do. And all of our guests who joined the conversation today, Gwendina Lee Gatewood, Dr. Rebecca St. Germain, Jonathan Nez, and of course, Lavinia Cody, appreciate all of your time and sharing with our listeners today. Join us again Monday when we'll look at two outstanding Native high school students who were among winners in one of the most prestigious science competitions in the country. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Davis Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our National Underwriting Sales Director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our Chief Operations Officer. The President and CEO of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. Native Forward Scholars Fund scholarships are open now. Native Forward supports Native students' higher education journeys, offering over 40 scholarship opportunities, programs, and resources designed for Native students. Info and applications at nativeforward.org who support this show.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.